Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:24 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is October 29th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with Australian government bonds because we've had a profound move in the two-year, and it went from not far off about 10-15 basis points at the beginning of the week to 77 by the end of the week. And it represents the potential here that the Australian Central Bank is moving away from its yield curve control. So that's going to put upward pressure on yields. And what I think is particularly interesting is if we just think about just 1 year forward from that and look at the three-year. And oftentimes in Australia, the three-year has tended to be more liquid. Well, it's up an additional 50 basis points. So when we think about that, it's not only has the three-year broken out faster and earlier than the two-year, but it's also pricing in a succession of interest rate hikes. So investors are willing to bet that Australia is not going to be able to sustain this extremely low interest rate environment indefinitely, and that there are plenty of inflationary pressures. And at least part of the reason for that is because coal prices have surged, natural gas prices have surged. Those are two really important exports for Australia. We've had a big move higher and then somewhat lower, although it hasn't quite unwound all of the advance just yet in iron ore as well. And that's all contributed to a terms of trade for Australia being significantly better than they were back in 2007 and 8. And obviously then a lot of inflationary pressures starting to manifest within the economy, because the price of imports is also increasing and the lockdowns have knocked big holes in the economy. So and of course Australia has been engaged in lockdowns longer than most. So even though the economy is now starting to live with the virus, then there are still inflationary pressures. But I think Australia is going to be a very interesting test case, because the government is not overly burdened with debt, but consumers are, and property prices are at extraordinary levels, and the quantity of and then of course we have the fact that a lot of those property prices are interest rate sensitive because of floating rate mortgages. So this significant pop on the upside, well then that's contributing to the potential that property prices will start to come down, or at least moderate, or have an impact on sentiment. And then what will that do to the ability of the central bank to continue to raise rates? So we're at a very interesting juncture, and if inflation does take off, well, will that then be able to further exaggerate the price of property? So that's one of the big questions, because the one thing that we've had over the course of decades has been this extremely lengthy period where bond yields contracted, and at the same time property prices rallied. And that's been the case in most of the developed world. Now, we're also seeing that large numbers of other countries are also raising rates. New Zealand has already raised rates, and the government bond there is in excess of 2%. Rather than thinking about the yield being back around where it is in Australia, around the levels we saw in 2019, in New Zealand, it's back around the levels seen in 2017. So they are also exploring this question about just how high can the bond yield go. Well, we also this week saw a big move in the yield curve spread for the USA. I've looked at yield curve spreads a lot, and the predictive power of the US yield curve and its ability to predict recessions is unparalleled. In other words, looking at yield curves for the rest of the world doesn't give us quite the same predictive power. And it just hasn't been able to, it hasn't married up quite as well with recessions in other parts of the world. And of course, the US is the largest economy in the world still. And this yield curve looks like it has put in at least a medium-term peak and now potentially a lower high. And if that's the case, well, then it would suggest that we are not going to get back up to the 250 basis point level difference between the twos and the tens, much less the 300 basis point level. And that it is much more likely that over the course of the next year that we're going to see some additional downside in this yield curve. Well, usually when the yield curve is contracting, it is representative of liquidity tightening, but stock markets generally can persist in doing well because growth remains reasonably benign and the willingness of the central bank to withdraw some of the liquidity starts to take some of the wind out of the inflationary argument, and that then allows stock prices to continue to advance. When we start to ask the question about just how high can yields go? Well, I think it's perhaps the most important question there is, because we're in a situation where a debt trap is a very real prospect. So that yield curve spread is currently just over 100 basis points. Well, what it suggests is that the 10-year yield could go to 2.5%, and that would probably cap it off. Or perhaps I think more likely is that you put another 100 basis points on the 2-year, and that's probably about as high as the yield could go. So we're at 50 basis points right now. If it were to get to 150 basis points, which would completely unwind the big decline from during the pandemic in 2020, that's probably about as high as the 2-year yield can go before we get to an inverted yield curve situation. And at that point, we would have to start pricing in the potential for the next recession. So what we're in right now is a big question mark. So are we going to have inflationary pressures that persist and push up interest rates? Or is inflation going to moderate significantly and therefore blunt the argument for raising rates in a hurry? But what it also suggests is that if we're talking about just another 100 basis points, well, that's only 4 interest rate hikes. That's really not very many. And it really helps to highlight just how big the debt is. And then we had the UK budget in here this week. And I think what we got from Rishi Sunak was representative of what we can expect from a large number of other countries, that the bond yield has popped on the upside. It did come back somewhat during the week, but then it firmed again all the way through to the end of the week. So it has now very clearly come all the way back up to test the base formation. And this base formation has been underway since 2008. The UK doesn't have nearly the same interest rate sensitivity as the USA does because the duration of the debt is over a decade, and about a quarter of that debt is index linked. So they do have some pushback in terms of the ability to completely inflate the debt away. And then of course the big question is how high can interest rates really go? So Rishi Sunak decided that he was going to go for spending and growth. He can do that because we've had a big rebound from the pandemic lows. So tax receipts are padding out the coffers of various governments. And that means that they have more money to spend and they're raising wages. The problem is that raising wages is sticky, and the rebound from the pandemic lows is a normalization. It's perhaps not, it would be rash to expect it to be a permanent condition. Then we can think about the fact that inflationary pressures are rising, and relationships with Europe are taut, and this is going to put upward pressure on prices. The UK has lost a large number of migrant workers, so that's going to put upward pressure on wages. And then, of course, there are these big questions about energy independence and the significant surge in energy prices over the last couple of months. That helps to, I think, emphasize the, well, I'm struggling to find a word other than foolishness, but the lack of wisdom in deploying or in relying on intermittent sources of energy when one is replacing one that provides base load. So when the wind stops blowing and natural gas prices or natural gas is in short supply, then we get these profound moves. Well, natural gas prices are starting to come back down, and coal prices are starting to come back down. So that is likely at least to blunt some of the inflationary pressures. But what we are seeing is wage demand growth. So wage demand growth is picking up just about everywhere. So that is going to contribute to inflationary pressures. The willingness of the government to spend, and then in the face of rising inflationary pressures, is also going to add to those inflationary pressures. So yields will continue to rise. But the UK also has floating rate mortgages and really quite high property prices. So then the big question is, how high can those interest rates go? Because eventually it's going to have an impact on the economy. It'll choke off growth, and then the central bank will be in a tight position because people will then continually ask for higher wages. If the cost of servicing one's mortgage continues to ramp higher, then you are definitely going to be marching on the streets and asking for more money and demanding more money. Because when the prospect of losing one's home because of rising interest rates becomes a political event, then you have to have higher wages. So when we think about inflationary pressures, there's certainly the potential that they will moderate, but then they're likely to ramp higher again. This is, I think, one of, this is why I have believed for quite some time that the logical parallel with what we're seeing now is the late 1960s and early 1970s. In other words, we're at the beginning of the new inflationary cycle, not the end. And that's why I remain quite bullish of gold. Now, gold prices have been forming this triangular pattern for the last 5 months. So we still have the sequence of higher reaction lows, and we still have lower highs, and volatility is decreasing. Now, the price today was down 15, but it's off the lows. And this is something that we've definitely seen more of in the last month. We've had these stabs on the downside, and they're not sustained, and they're being used as buying opportunities. So every time we've had one of these stabs on the downside, it's rallied back. Now what it needs to do is to string together a few days on the upside, sustain the move above $1,800, break out from above the highs put in between July and September, and then we'll be talking about higher highs. And there's the significant potential that once it's broken the triangular pattern, that we will have an explosive breakout. And this will begin to price in the inflation to come. There's certainly been a lot of, well, I guess a year ago, there was a lot of enthusiasm about gold because it had done spectacularly well in the couple of years previous. And then we had this lengthy period of consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. So that unwound the overbought condition, and because of the significant advances that we've seen in stocks, well, then we've also had a lot of competition, and Bitcoin in particular has been a lightning rod for speculation. And the Bitcoin price continues to hold around the 60,000 level, and this remains a reasonably consistent advance and a reasonably benign consolidation overall. And so far, it's holding the 60,000 level pretty well. Ethereum broke on the upside to new highs in here today. So this stellar performance by the cryptocurrency sector has certainly sapped some investment and speculative demand from other sectors, and most particularly gold, because gold hasn't been going anywhere. Now, the big question is always going to be, where does the additional liquidity come from to continue to support the market? One thing I definitely notice is that the Shiba Inu coin has gone up several thousand percent in the last year. It's now in the top 10 in terms of size for the cryptocurrency market, and it's effectively one of these joke coins. So we definitely have had a lot of speculative activity in the cryptocurrency world, and of course, it's been very liquidity driven. And of course, this also comes back to this question about just how high can interest rates go? Because liquidity and access to additional liquidity has been the fuel for the big bull market in cryptocurrencies. And I updated my Fangman index this week, and I included Tesla. So Tesla also has a significant weighting in Bitcoin, and it did spectacularly well over the last 2 weeks, breaking higher on the news that they've sold 100,000 vehicles to Hertz. And I do like this Fangman relative to the total market cap of the NYSE index, because it really helps to highlight that you didn't really need to own anything other than those 8 shares, which are Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, and Tesla between 2013 and the middle of 2020. And that if you owned just those 8 shares, then you would have outperformed the total market by a really quite considerable margin, because it went from about 6% of the total market to 22% of the total market in that 7 or 8 years. And now it's right back in the region of the peaks. And we've had, and the news today was that Apple, for example, is going to have difficulty meeting supply because of the semiconductor shortage and supply chain difficulties. So they're going to have difficulty getting everyone the devices that they wanted for the holiday season. Amazon is looking at significantly higher costs, particularly from wages and shipping costs, so that could erase their profit for the fourth quarter. And I think it's important to simply look at this relative chart, that despite this news, the chart is still doing well. And then Apple was down in here today, Amazon, but rallied well off the low. Amazon was also in negative territory today, and it's been ranging for really quite a long time, but it was off its low. Whereas Microsoft continues to power on the upside, was in additional positive territory in here today. Tesla also remains in a clear upward trend. One thing that I thought was interesting, and it's the cost of the options. So if one were to simply buy the January options, and even with calls, it has to go up another $115 before you make any money. And based upon the momentum we've seen this week, that's probably not a big ask. But the options cost 10% of the strike value, which is rather high. So it's going to be hard to make money in some of these options. And yet we continue to see that there's lots of volume. And there were four, well, those are puts. I do apologize. These are the calls, and it's really around the same price. And some of these calls have got significant volume. And we got 3,000 contracts trading. And these are the, just in 2 weeks' time, it's anticipating that Tesla will go up another $65. So these are really expensive. And it helps to highlight that we're in a speculative environment. But a speculative environment does not mean a top. And the NASDAQ 100 remains in a reasonably consistent advance. And it's closed at a new all-time high in here today. And we have a sequence of ranges, one above another. So it's still a consistent trend. And when we have consistent trends, they're really easy to analyze, because we can't have a top until we start to see inconsistencies creeping in. And that would either represent an acceleration, and we're starting to see accelerations in shares like Nvidia and in Microsoft, or we'd need to see a really big loss of momentum and a much lengthier range. There's no sign of that yet. Or we'd have to move into a much more violent, volatile pattern. So far, we're in a consistent trend, and a consistent trend is a trend in motion. And as long as the trend remains intact and we continue to see ranges one above another and breakouts that are sustained, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Of course, we can look at the dominance of the market by just 8 shares representing 22% of the total market cap of the NYSE. And obviously, that's an extraordinary achievement for those 8 companies, and they are the companies that have done best during the environment of quantitative easing and very low interest rates and abundant liquidity, and their business models are primed to continue to benefit from that condition, and their ability to continue to advance, well, that's very much dependent on interest rates not rising. So we're in an environment where inflationary pressures are moving higher, but they could moderate over the course of the next couple of months, because let's first look at, for example, Newcastle Coal. And Newcastle Coal went up in just an extraordinary manner as China was importing and panicking about getting additional supplies for the winter. And then it is coming straight back down again. Then we had the massive move higher in natural gas prices, in Europe in particular. So this was just a profound move. They went to 400. Now they're down to 165. So that's obviously seeing some easing of the pressure. And the natural gas price in the US is also starting to come lower. One thing I think is interesting is that as we have the Global Climate Conference next week, and people are talking about the need to create a globally fungible carbon market, we don't even have a globally fungible natural gas market. So, and that's a completely market-driven phenomenon. It's difficult to move this stuff around. And building the infrastructure for liquefied natural gas has taken years. And we still don't have a globally fungible market, although certainly we're a lot closer to it today than we were in the past. And natural gas prices are right in the region of the $6 level, so there's certainly potential here that prices are going to start coming down as the European price comes down as well. Now, when we think about inflationary pressures, well, lumber prices, for example, were down the limit in here today. And it gives us, I think, what's a good example of what we can expect from some of these energy commodities, where we had the massive accelerations and we're now starting to see the decline. Well, it's quite likely that the breakouts will hold, but that achieving those highs seen earlier this year is going to be very difficult for the near term. And we are likely to move into a much more rangy environment where higher prices are held on average. So it's quite likely that lumber prices won't come back below the 400 level, and that we'll have trough to peak swings of 100% between about 400 and 800 for the foreseeable future, in just the same way that we had trough to peak swings of 200 to 400 in the decades prior to the first move higher in 2018. And I suspect that that is likely what we're going to see with natural gas in Europe, that the prevailing price before the pandemic is not going to be revisited. So if that occurs, it's going to moderate some of the inflationary pressures. We're going to see energy starting to come back down. The extraordinarily high fertilizer prices, for example, in Europe, where you have the farming community worrying about gaining access to supply and what that's going to do to yields, that's all likely to moderate over the course of the next 6 months. Of course, there is an argument that the big rally in gold in 2019 and 20 priced in the inflation that we're seeing now, and the obvious logical extension of that argument is that the range that we've had in gold is pricing in the potential that inflationary pressures will moderate over the course of the next few months. But then I do think that there is significant potential for inflation to ramp higher again after that. And I really think that it is down to the real potential that people all over the world are going to start agitating for higher wages because they won't be able to afford to pay their mortgages. And then we can think about the deflationary impact that carbon pricing on a global basis would have on the global economy. Because the alarmists at the UN are, and the media commentary around carbon pricing is amping higher as we approach the conference next week. And they're arguing that we need to get to a zero carbon environment by 2030, in other words, a little more than 8 years from now, if we're going to avert a warming of more than a degree and a half. I think it's perhaps time, although obviously they're not willing to do that yet, to start thinking about it would probably be much better to spend our time and effort trying to prepare coastal regions for the kind of warming that's likely, rather than spending a ton of money and trying to avoid it with a very uncertain outcome. And this is almost similar to the kind of argument about whether to become vaccinated or not. Some people think that there is extraordinary risk on the long-term consequences. So that's long-term uncertainty. And they are not going to take it because of the long-term uncertainty. And then they give up the near-term certainty that one is less likely to end up in hospital if one is vaccinated. So then you can apply the same rationale to the argument about climate change. There is the long-term uncertainty about whether all of the efforts being put into play, which would be to completely shut down carbon emissions within the next 8 years, and the massive impact that that would have on the global economy. It would be a deflation on a scale previously unimaginable, and a massive loss of living standards for billions of people. And it is not guaranteed to avert the climate change that people are afraid of. Whereas the near-term certainty of building sea walls, well, at least that would ensure that there is some efforts underway that would at least ameliorate some of the potential problems. And with the migration of the global population to the coast rather than the interiors of continents, well, building desalination plants seems to be something that would be very obvious. And then, of course, if one is really worried about climate change and really gives full credence to the potential that the global climate is in irreversible change and flux, and that the volatility of weather events is going to amplify further over the years, well, then building wind farms and building solar panels, well, those depend on the weather not changing. And if one believes in that, well, believes in weather volatility, well, then it's going to be, if those are intermittent, they're going to be progressively more intermittent, and that the supply from those sources is going to be even more volatile in future. And this is something that has been sort of developing. It's an argument that's been developing at the back of my head for the last few months, is this difference between robustness and fragility. Because low interest rates contribute to a fragile environment. When you can always refinance, well, then you're not really under any real pressure. And I really find it interesting that the number of people I've met whose profession is private equity has increased substantially over the course of the last few years. And I don't know whether that is because the circles of people that I'm meeting and talking to, or whether just the sheer numbers of people that make private equity their profession have increased. But one thing I know for sure is that I would say almost a third of the new people that I meet, and they say that they're involved in private equity, or that they're interested in buying new companies, and they're always interested in the next new thing. And this I find particularly interesting because this is a business model that is predicated on low interest rates persisting indefinitely. And inflation doesn't suit every business. And taking old world businesses and digitizing them, that's certainly something that's been a really quite profitable venture. But then we can think about what Facebook is doing. Because Facebook was the first company to really benefit from social media and 4G. And the share has done admirably well from 2013 all the way through until now. Now, and that business model was essentially based upon gaining access to the next wave of young people. So, Facebook targeted the people who were in their 20s, and then they bought Instagram, which had the next youngest demographic. They bought WhatsApp, which had a younger demographic, and it's a race to the bottom then in the race to try and capture the next demographic. And they've given up trying to compete because the speed with which social media apps can now acquire 1 billion users has accelerated significantly. So TikTok did it in less than 2 years. And it stands to reason that the next big social media platform that succeeds after TikTok will do it even faster. So that also means that the amount of time through which a company can enjoy their dominance of the market is going to contract. And Facebook has now renamed themselves to Meta Platforms, and they are looking more at potentially moving beyond social media and thinking that they will be the primary access point to interact permanently with the internet. So we interact with the internet through social media, through entertainment, and through work, through interactions and meetings. And Facebook wants to take a part out of all of that time spent during the day. So the share is now right back in the region of the trend mean, and investors seem to be willing to give it the benefit of the doubt in the short term. And it also should help to blunt some of the most aggressive arguments about market abuse that Facebook has faced, that they are now moving away from that race to the bottom in terms of trying to access or try to gain access to the youngest possible demographic. In the financial sector, the buy now, pay later phenomenon is also trying to do the same thing. So now what we see is a clear trend to giving teenagers credit. So this is moving way out on the risk profile. And obviously it's something that needs to be paid attention to. Because if interest rates rise, well then obviously that's going to come under pressure. But of course, my whole argument is that interest rates are going to have a very difficult time rising, and that's likely to continue to support speculative interest. So we've had a bit of a pullback on some of these very large companies, but that we still remain in a reasonably benign environment overall. And inflationary pressures are picking up in places like Europe, but that it's likely that inflation is going to moderate for a few months before it ramps back up again. And in that time, we can continue to see a bull market evolve overall. Now, when we think about where are things likely to pop up and become problematic, well, China is certainly one of those areas because there is this big question and they don't know the answer. And it's how much debt is outstanding. And high yield spreads in China continue to ramp higher. So when high yield is up around 10%, well, then we have to bear in mind that there are problems in the high yield sector in China. Well, they don't know how much debt they have, and they're trying to figure it out. And they've gone into the property development sector because those were the buyers of land. But they haven't gone yet into any great extent as to how much off-balance sheet debt do the sellers of that land have, which are all the municipal governments. And it's likely to ramp higher into the trillions. And this is obviously a big phenomenon for China. Now, that's a good part of the reason why they continue to clamp down on capital controls. It's a good reason why China is very interested in creating a digital currency because it would effectively be a domestic ration book and it wouldn't be fungible with the offshore renminbi. So it would only be used for very particular purchases of vital goods and services within the country. And of course, that's also something that's likely to contribute to some play in the currency. And the property sector is being managed lower. And the renminbi was a little weaker in here today. So there's the potential here that the renminbi has strengthened about as much as it is likely to. And that the pressure that's coming to bear on the economy, where Evergrande made an additional interest rate payment, or excuse me, interest payment on one of its bonds today. So it still hasn't defaulted, but it's squeaking at past each one of these successive timetables. And it has billions in liability that come due and mature in 2022 and 2023. So this is a problem that is going to rattle along for quite some time. And what China is doing right now is they're playing for time. Well, what that also helps to suggest is that there's the potential that we're going to start seeing some deflation coming through from China, because growth is going to take a hit if they're not supplying considerable additional liquidity. Now, when we think about the total amount of money that's being printed by central banks, well, the central bank balance sheet total assets has been trending higher for what really feels like an awfully long time, and it's still close to all-time peaks. So that's 32 trillion that is helping to support asset prices overall. And then we also have global deficits that aren't likely to contract in a meaningful fashion anytime soon. So that's also contributing to the supply of liquidity that's coming into the market when global governments are running deficits in the order of 2 trillion. That's a lot of money that helps to support asset prices. Of course, it's also helping to stoke inflationary pressures. So these are, and I think this again is quite similar to what we saw in the early 1970s, that inflation was surging from time to time, and then it moderated in between. And the devaluation of fiat currencies, that really created the situation where OPEC was formed and then agitated for higher prices. And the willingness of the oil majors to spend is being impacted by this effort to create a global zero carbon economy. So the oil majors are not spending, they're not investing in additional new supply. That's handing power back to OPEC, and it's helping to support oil prices overall. And the oil price was well off its low yesterday, and it was pretty much unchanged in here today. If natural gas prices continue to come lower, and eventually we'll see some additional supply starting to come through because of these higher prices. But a lot of the drilled but incomplete wells, we can find a chart for that. A lot of those wells have already been utilized. So we need to see a new drilling cycle to create additional new wells. And the number of drilled but incompletes has contracted from 9,000 to 5,300 in the space of the last year and a bit. So there are a lot fewer wells ready to be drilled, even though 5,000 is still substantially more than we'd seen ahead of the big drilling cycle from 2013 onwards. And that means that it's going to take money to start a new drilling cycle, and that's likely to support the oil services sector, because high oil prices should help to encourage additional spending in normal circumstances. The big question today, of course, is how high do prices have to go to overcome the fear of being accused of raping the world? And this is obviously having an impact. And then, because of the extraordinary volatility we've had in natural gas prices, European producers in particular are starting to come back down. So Royal Dutch Shell is unwinding its short-term overbought condition right now. Equinor had got all the way back up to test the highs from the last few years, and then it's pulled back in a dynamic manner this week. So that's a peak of at least near-term significance and greatly increases the scope that we're going to come back down and test the region of the trend mean. So there's at least another 10, if not 15 or 20% of fat that could be taken out of the price right now. And even then, it might still be in a broad trending environment if the sequence of higher reaction lows can remain intact. And of course, then if inflationary pressures are going to moderate, well, then gold should continue to do well. And the gold shares, well, the one thing they're not doing is investing in a lot of new supply. And there hasn't been any major new discoveries for the last 4 years. So they're going to have to go through an investment cycle eventually. And one of the reasons why the sector underperformed last time around was because they spent every available cent on exploration and development. And on this occasion, they're a lot more disciplined. And they know that investors are going to be very reluctant to support the sector if they err from their balance sheet discipline. So it's a very cheap sector overall with world-beating free cash flow at the present time. And the vast majority of miners are producing at levels that are considerably below the prevailing oil pr gold price. I remain very much of the view that copper is the linchpin for the argument about the nexus between demand from electrification, which is being supported by governments, and the issues that are occurring with China and its property market. If copper prices can continue to hold the $4 area, then this is likely to remain a very benign environment. If copper breaks downwards, well, it's likely to represent trouble for China. What I think is particularly interesting as well is that India is clearly benefiting from this transition. Now, the Nifty index has come down in a dynamic manner this week, and it has been extremely impressive on the upside. So it wouldn't be at all surprising if we see some pause in consolidation, and I think it would be healthy if we see it come back and test the region of the trend mean. And that would probably set up the next buying opportunity, but certainly I don't think anyone needs to be in a hurry to buy India. But India is in a new credit cycle. So unlike in China, where they are voluntarily trying to deleverage the property sector and the municipal government sector, and they are toying with introducing a property tax. India has already gone through a significant bankruptcy cycle with the housing finance sector, and now they're coming out the other end of it. And they're now entering the period of time where the demographic dividend has the potential to really pay off in terms of growth. So India could quite clearly be a growth driver for the wider economy over the coming years. And if that's the case, then it could quite easily benefit from lower commodity prices if that's what we see. But it's also likely to be a beneficiary from any agreement that's made about the climate, because India is without doubt an emerging market. China is still classified as an emerging market, and yet it's the second largest economy in the world. So, just how much longer they're going to be able to claim that designation is open to question. The logical answer would be to provide countries like India and other swiftly developing high population countries with technology necessary to skip at coal-fired power stations. So either provide them with the necessary equipment and infrastructure to import natural gas and or provide them with the necessary technology to benefit from small mobile nuclear reactors. Now, arguably, that particular technology is still in a developmental stage, and the US government, the US military is pioneering it because it's part of their answer to how to deal with climate change. And of course, they're working on a factual basis rather than a political basis. They want to be able to preserve their mobility and their ability to act on a moment's notice. So, the fact that the US military has gone from relying on the electric net or the electricity utilities and is instead going it alone, I think that should help to emphasize that it is uranium is the clearest potential. Now, uranium prices are rather difficult to monitor, so I think it is just simple to pay attention to how the ETFs are performing. And the ETF was in negative territory this week, and not least because of the volatility we're seeing in some of the other commodities. But then this is an energy commodity, and so is natural gas, and oil prices have been quite steady, and I think we're likely to see some additional volatility in energy commodities. And we've had some volatility in the industrial resources, and then the question is how much further will that go on, and how slow will the growth be in China? And of course, if China does slow down, then it will delay the tightening of every other central bank, and most particularly in the USA and Europe, and that will help to support speculative interest, particularly on growth shares. Then we can pay attention to what's going on in terms of agricultural prices, because fertilizers have surged higher. That's creating a problem for farmers. Wheat is pushing on the upside. Corn has broken out of its short-term range and is pushing higher again. These are major food commodities. And rough rice tends to be a rather choppy commodity because of the big backwardations and contangos, and it's this is just the January contract, and it's now right in the region of the trend mean and beginning to steady. So there's the real potential that we're going to have issues with food prices. So again, this is likely to contribute to rolling inflationary pressures, that we get one sector popping on the upside and creating problems, and then another that then that sector ameliorates and something else does just starts popping on the upside afterwards. The Baltic Dry Index is coming back down, so it's been down in a dynamic manner now 3 weeks in a row. So that's pricing in the potential that some of the bottlenecks will begin to ease. And now the question is, will it hold the region of the trend mean? It's definitely for the bulls to prove, and we will need to see a clear upper dynamic to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. If I were to just take a minute to summarize, I think that we are in a new inflationary environment, and that those inflationary forces are going to persist, that we're in a debt trap environment because central banks, particularly in the developed world, are going to have difficulty raising rates because of the impact it's going to have on the total debt in the economy. Now, who owes that debt is different in every country, but the quantity of outstanding debt, if you combine the government and the household sector and the corporate sector, it's going to fall somewhere. And that's going to have an idiosyncratic effect on different countries. And it's going to inhibit central banks from raising rates, despite the fact that we have inflation, because it will threaten the persistence of the expansions. And that's likely to contribute to a doubling down of focus on stocks, which is why we continue to have this consistent trend on the Nasdaq. And we continue to see that those eight Fang Man and Tesla shares continue to perform so admirably because investors are continuing to bet that interest rates can't rise. So this debt trap environment, it's eventually going to cause a problem because inflation will eventually get out of hand and will necessitate that interest rates have to rise, and that will cause the next recession. But we're not there yet. And until the yield curve becomes inverted, and before we get the clear determination to raise rates, well, then the chances are that we're going to move into a big bubble. And we're already in a bubbly environment because interest rates are low, valuations are high, and it's quite likely that valuations are going to get even more aggressive. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.